Welcome to the Trade Show Podcast, the home for conversations with global leaders in the trade show and events business. Our show will bring you face to face with experts who speak about the possibilities and trajectories of this $50 billion industry. I'm your host, Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make conversion easy. Welcome to this episode of the Trade Show Podcast. Thank you for listening and your continued feedback. If you have suggestions or you want me to dig in with a specific guest, please write to me at shubhanjan@pitch.link or message me on LinkedIn. Both links available in the show notes. I'm delighted to introduce our guest today, David Peckinpah, President and CEO, Maritz, a multi-solution company that empowers clients to achieve their full potential through understanding, enabling, and motivating employees, channel partners, and customers. I had a long-ranging conversation with David, including ones like event ROI and attendee engagement, topics that we have been discussing for four decades, and uncommon ones like sustainability and human trafficking. Join us for a great session.
Yeah, I tell you right now, the corporate marketplace is really strong. And I think that's somewhat unusual because usually in any kind of economic sort of turmoil, what we see is the corporate market either holds tight or constricts. And we're not seeing that. We're actually seeing the opposite. We're seeing a more robust investment, more commitment to in-person events. And that's very encouraging.
David Peckinpah has been with Maritz since 2011 and assumed the position of President and CEO of Maritz in 2021. A 40-plus year champion of events industry, David provides strategic oversight of Maritz while ensuring the consistent design and delivery of engaging and inspiring program experiences that drive business results. Since joining in 2011, David has led the company through significant growth, placing renewed focus on clients, industry partnerships, and global presence. He has also invested in re-energizing the company's culture, introducing the company's signature core value, take good care of each other, which has led to the company-wide purpose of unleashing human potential. This aspirational initiative is based on a focus on the triple bottom line, where financial, people, and sustainability results are equally recognized and celebrated. In addition, David has also championed the company's fight against human trafficking and to build awareness throughout the events industry of this insidious crime. His passion and advocacy on behalf of the events industry has earned David accolades and recognition from peers and organizations, including MPI Rise Awards, Meeting Industry Leadership, the Joint Meetings Industry Council's Unity Award, Incentive Travel Council's Advocate of the Year Award, the Boeing Institute of International Business International Visionary Award, induction into the Events Industry Council's Hall of Leaders, a recipient of the 2025 PACT Freedom Awards, and the Lifetime Achievement Award, Business Event Organizer, as part of PCMA's Visionary Awards. David is a past member of the Board of Directors of PCMA, past chairman of the PCMA Education Foundation, and original co-chairman of the Meetings Mean Business Coalition. In addition, David is a certified meeting planner by the Events Industry Council, certified incentive specialist from SITE, and is a certified master designer from Maritz. David is married with two grown children and has a passion for sailing, skiing, and travel. Now, onto this insightful episode with David Peckinpah. David, welcome to the Trade Show Podcast. I'm delighted to have you here and thank you for making time just before you have to hit a baseball game.
Thank you, Shubhanjan. That's very nice of you and glad to be here.
Thank you. I just want to dive right in and ask you about the competitive landscape that you see from where you are. We were just discussing that it's when we talk of events, trade shows, these are sort of separate packets yet somewhere connected to each other. What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's, Maritz is a very interesting company in that we serve virtually every market there is. We serve the corporate marketplace, and that includes incentive, brand events, massive corporate events, et cetera. We also serve the association market. And that's typically the association annual meeting, big trade shows as well. Then we're also in the for-profit trade show space, and we serve many of the top, let's say, 100 shows in the country. And that's with a whole variety of services. So we have a pretty unique perspective, I think, on the landscape and what's going on. And, you know, we're always asked, like, what is your competitive set? And my answer is it really depends on each one of those markets. And it also depends on the services that we're talking about. We're a full service agency. So we compete with virtually everybody. So the competitive landscape is quite interesting. I think our number one competitor, we always say, is somewhat of the in-house planner that is trying to make that decision whether they keep everything in-house or do they outsource. And so that's the big opportunity for us, is how do we access and show the value of outsourcing as an extension of their team and the work that they do, not as a replacement for. So that's sort of a clarifying statement about merits. I think if we're going to zero in on the trade show space, all of our personal experience, recent experience, is probably what you would expect. Very robust, very strong. I think for the last 4+ years, the investment and dedication to in-person trade show events has never been stronger. I think where we see sort of challenges on the outskirts are right now, from a U.S. perspective, is inbound international visitation. That's certainly taking a hit right now. And that is particularly true from our North America neighbors. Right. We're suffering quite a bit from Canada, and we're suffering quite a bit from Mexico. And that has to do with some of the more geopolitical issues that are swirling around, from tariffs to governmental relationships. So, but we're still very bullish on the marketplace, very, very confident in the future. And so, right now it's a very strong marketplace with some challenges that we all are having to deal with.
I will come down to challenges, but before we leave this this topic, when you look at this, the entire gamut or spectrum of things that Maritz is into, what are the big growth engines that you see, say, over the next 5 years?
Yeah, I tell you right now, the corporate marketplace is really strong. And I think that's somewhat unusual, because usually in any kind of economic sort of turmoil, what we see is the corporate market either holds tight or constricts. And we're not seeing that. We're actually seeing the opposite. We're seeing a more robust investment, more commitment to in-person events. And that's very encouraging. I think the other big opportunities for growth for us is in the for-profit trade show space. I think you see a lot of consolidation going on in the industry, a lot of M&A or acquisition activity. And I think as those investments occur, the key people behind those investments are trying to drive efficiency and drive profit. And outsourcing is typically seen as a very efficient way to drive some of those factors for a deal, for an acquisition deal. So I think we still see a lot of opportunity there. And in the trade show space in particular, we offer what we call a integrated solution, which is housing and registration and lead retrieval. We have a lot of competitors on just the housing front, competitors on the registration front, but not many have that integrated solution. And so we see that as a big differentiator, and a lot of our customers are really gravitating towards that.
I wanted to ask you about ROI, and I think this provides me a sort of a segue to get into that. When people think of ROI, and feel free to separate it out between corporate events and trade shows in general, how do you think people, how do you see people thinking about ROI currently?
Yeah, the challenge, I think, is that this has been an ongoing dialogue for decades. I mean, I've been in the industry for 40 years. We've been talking about ROI and how to define ROI for 40 years. And I think we're getting maybe closer because of some of the technology and data analytic tools that we have to really prove that. But I think I always turn it around and go back to the individual, which is the organization that's making the investment. The critical thing is, how do they define their ROI? And, you know, we have a design practice that we've started back in 2011. And one of the first things we do is we dig into that with the stakeholders, is what are the goals and objectives of the event? Why are you making this investment? And what are the results that you expect out of that? Then as your partner, we will help you measure that and then help you define your ROI. I don't think it's universal across the board. Certainly, there are some things you could look at, let's say, from a trade show perspective, number of exhibitors, lead retrieval, engagement, booth traffic. You know, some of those are sort of the givens. But yeah. What we find is every organization has their own set of parameters on what they define success to be. So it's not a one size fits all. I think it is very customized. And that's the approach we take, is we really dig into that initial set of questions. And then we're pretty clear on what's going to drive our design process, and then how are we going to measure success. And then we have that scorecard definition set between us and the customer. Mm-hmm. And that tends to serve us very well.
And do you see any conflict internally in the customer? So one is, of course, you talk about the organizers. Then the other, I think the base unit would be the exhibitor.
Correct.
Do you see internal conflicts in trying to come to terms? Because when I'm talking to a lot of exhibitors and organizers, I hear this a lot, that finally, somehow, the typical B2B sales conflicts between marketing and sales also surface in trade shows. It's just that it's happening in a smaller sort of geography, right? Very in great proximity, but it still happens. Do you see any of that?
We don't see a lot of that. I think what we observe is that there's some organizations that really do it and do it well, and then there are a lot of organizations that really sort of take it for granted and don't pay attention. So we try to help them improve their approach to their own data analytics. We have a tool called EventBit, which is something we rolled out almost a decade ago, which is the measurement of behavior on the trade show floor. So we have a lot of ability to do analytics to work with our customer, both the exhibitor, who's a customer, and also the trade show organizer, to really sort of blend that together and to break down those barriers, because everyone has the same goal. Right. The organizer's goal is to make those exhibitors as successful as possible. And the exhibitors want to be as successful as possible. Now, I can tell you, it's a widespread of approach and skill set, exhibitor to exhibitor. Some really get it. They know how to really organize and execute an effective trade show booth. And there are a lot that still don't get it. And it's amazing to me to this day that, you know, you'll walk by and someone's eating in the booth and not paying attention, and you just scratch your head because of the investment these companies are making. But the ones that are really good and sophisticated, they have their own data analytic tools. They know exactly what to do with those leads, and they're very efficient in the follow up and the sales and marketing process to maximize the investment they're making. So we don't see a lot of that conflict, and what we're trying to do is to help break down those barriers and. Right. Make that more efficient.
I'll quickly run by a piece of statistics, which I again hear a lot. It seems that 70% of exhibitors do not follow up on the leads that they capture. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, it's astounding. That's kind of what I was alluding to, is that the organizations that are really sophisticated and on top of it, that could never, ever occur. But there are a lot. You see all those statistics and you just shake your head. I mean, why are you making the investment? And it's investment not in just the cost of the booth, but it's personnel, it's travel, it's all the ancillary expenses that come into play. When we do exhibit at a lot of shows, I can tell you that's not how we approach it, right? We have a very robust process and methodology on not only how we capture the leads, how we follow up, and how we nurture those leads. Because we all know there's right wide variety of quality of those leads. Some are just looky-loos, and some are really serious. So if you have the right business development approach, then that should never be the case. But yeah, we absolutely see that. And it's shocking and it's surprising. You know, whoever is in charge of those budgets is not asking the right questions.
I agree. You are talking about the strong comeback over the last 3-4 years of the industry. So I want to go back to COVID. It's a watershed event. So no question.
Yes,
about
it
that.
Is. Yes, it is. Or was.
The trade, yeah, and the trade show industry, which is fundamentally about being face to face, practically shut down overnight.
Right. We're our businesses were outlawed. I mean, it's we couldn't gather more than 50 people or more. So yeah, I mean, we were put out of business for quite a period of time.
I just want to know. I mean, as a CEO, what were you thinking when this first hit, and how did you sort of maneuver through this stage? I mean, I think it must have been like very, very challenging.
Oh, it was hell on wheels. I mean, there's no doubt about it. And I think a lot of us have PTSD coming out of that to some degree. And, you know, you think back and it's almost like a mirage, right? Because it just hits so fast and so hard. I mean, I think the initial thought is we all thought it was going to be 90 days in and out and we're back to business. And so when people talk about lessons learned, I mean, that's 100% hindsight. But, you know, we probably would have made different decisions knowing the length of the impact that it was going to have. You know, I think our commitment from day one was to communicate, and that was to communicate robustly with our customers and with our people. We were not going to take the foot off the accelerator of innovation. So we kept our innovation practice alive and well, and did some really interesting things around digital meetings and how do you survive when you can't gather face to face. And then our commitment to making sure that we were better as a company coming out of that downturn than we were going into it. And I think as we look at our scorecard and what our goals and objectives were back in March of 2020 and how we succeeded, I think we have a lot to be proud of. We made mistakes. We didn't do everything right. But we lived to those three tenets, right? We communicated like crazy. We kept our foot on the accelerator around innovation, and we came out a stronger company as a result of it. But a lot of pain, a lot of cultural hits, and things that we've had to work really hard to rebound from. But we are much stronger, and we just had 3 record years in a row. So, and that's all-time record. So we've not only surpassed 2019, but we're setting new bars each year. So, you know, that's very encouraging. But yeah, it was not a fun thing to go to. I've told our owner, if another one hits, I'm out of here. I'm too old to go through that again. Let somebody younger do it. But yeah, it took everything we had to get through those days.
Would you recollect a specific challenge which you thought was going to be insurmountable, but then you figured it out? I mean, what comes to your mind as the biggest one?
Well, there are 2 that come to mind. One is, how do we take care of our people when 85% of your revenue disappears, right? So, I mean, we had to make a lot of really tough decisions. But our commitment was, number one, is to survive, right? The best thing we can do to take care of our people is to survive. And while we had to do massive furloughs and layoffs and set, you know, pay cuts and all the things that everyone had to do, our number one commitment in our cultural statement is first taking care of each other. And that's a 4-stakeholder model. It's our people, our clients, our suppliers, and our communities. And to do that and to stay true to that, you had to survive. So that was really our commitment and rule number one. And I think, you know, all the things that we either did right or wrong, we came out of that with that true statement, because we, you know, now we're employing more people than we ever have, and we're taking good care of our people and all the things that we thought were really critically important. So I think that was probably the number one thing that sort of was front and center. That was part of that experience.
And you said another one, you said 2 comes to mind.
Yeah, I think the the opportunity that we all explored was, what are we going to do around digital events, both trade show and other events? And we actually almost acquired a digital platform company in 2020, because at that time you thought, well, this is absolutely have to be a significant part of the future. And that, frankly, is something that we got wrong in our crystal ball. I think you now look at the landscape, and while some sort of virtual component or educational content capture component is part of event strategies, you don't see nearly the, I mean, we had, over 300 virtual events, I think at one point in a single month, and now we're down to a handful a year. It is a significant difference. So that was the other one that, yes, that we thought was going to be much more critical to our future and has proven not to be. It's an ancillary strategy, I think, for trade shows and for event organizers. But it hasn't certainly, what we thought possibly could replace face-to-face and in-person. It's not. It's an enhancement. It's another part of your event strategy, but it is not the core of the event strategy.
Sure. Just to extend that thought a bit, and what you're saying is echoed by most leaders that I've been talking to. Why do you think this happened? Because there is a value to the digital component, especially when people have to travel to go to a certain,
right,
certain show. Obviously, the efficacy of a face-to-face meeting cannot be done through this, especially when you're trying to do something more than exchanging content or right, pleasantries and so on. Why do you think that the decline of digital conferences, shows, whatever you call them, was this steep?
I think it comes down to, a couple of things. I think one, it comes down to basic human behavior. And Meritz has built our business for 132 years on a deep understanding of human behavior, neuroscience. And the fact is, people crave to gather. And that was never shown to be more true than as we exited out of the pandemic in 2021, et cetera. So I think that's fundamental on what we found. Also, I think there was a massive fatigue, which also, I think, had it been more incremental, maybe it would have taken hold more permanently. But I think because we were all so dramatically forced into that environment, and we found it so non-inspirational, is that a word? Non-inspiring, that people then immediately gravitated back to trying to meet in person. You know, a couple of things that we've learned is, and it's something we've been saying now for a number of years, is that the impact of that is that now we find that time is the currency of events. And that's something I talk a lot about, is how people now invest their time is really, really critical to them. And so if they're making the decision to get on a plane, travel, stay in a hotel, attend a conference, the value that has to be delivered through that event, whether it's a trade show or a corporate association event, has got to be significant. And so I think that's put more onus on the organizer, the designers of those events, so that those individuals are making that decision. Right, that I want to invest my time, and here's the benefit I'm going to get, and that value outweighs the opportunity to hop online and listen to content. But I think that's part of it, and I think the other is, from an organizer perspective, you have to provide a unique value in that in-person gathering that simply cannot be done in a virtual environment. And so, we organize our own events for our clients and our partners, and we take that very seriously in our design practice, right? We've got to make sure that what we're doing in person simply cannot be done in a virtual environment. And that shines through, and that differentiates, and that makes the investment of those events absolutely worthwhile. So, I think that's the fundamental answer, is it's comes out. It's like what we see in our office. We don't have an office mandate. yet our offices are full and busy, our physical offices. And our people have the ability to work from home. And I can tell you in 2021 and 22, offices weren't full. But the last 2 or 3 years, particularly Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Monday, Fridays are a little lighter, particularly Fridays. Other than that, our parking lots are full. Our people are there. They're energized. Teams are meeting. I mean, it just makes a difference. You just do things differently when you're in person than you do in a virtual environment. So it's kind of a long-winded answer, but I think it's those.
No. This is great because I want to talk a bit about attendee engagement, but I'll come to that in a moment. I still want to sort of talk to you about the innovations that's happening in Meritz.
Great.
What kind of areas are you seeing the innovation happening? What was the goal or idea with which you started the design practice? I just want to dig in with a few of those where you experimented with things which were not typically part of this industry, right?
Yeah, I think the one of the things that we're most proud of is our design practice. And I go back to 1999 when I was with a company called Confron that became Experient that we acquired in 2012. Mm-hmm. I was introduced to a gentleman by the name of Jim Gilmore, and Jim and Joe Pine wrote a book called "It's All About Design and Practice." It's oh my gosh, I'm absolutely spacing on it. It'll come back to me. The name of his book,
sure.
Anyway, the Pine and Gilmore book on experiences is really fundamental to why we have focused so much on design. I think what they brought. It's, by the way, the book is The Experience Economy,
right.
And has been now republished, and they've written books called Authenticity, and Jim has written a book called Look. So it's an ongoing relationship we've had with Jim, and I would always point to him as sort of the fundamental reason why, and going back to 1999, we got involved in experience design. And it really was that every business is a theater, right? And you have to look at it that way, and then well, we took that to then into the event space, and Jim has been part of our sort of team on a looser basis ever since, right? We just had him at one of our events just recently. Having that thought partner along with, at that point, we had a organization called the Meritz Institute, which is now sort of morphed into our Meritz Collective. But it was an area where we had an internal practice really focused and based on neuroscience, human behavior, starting with Maslow and some other works. And, you know, that's been foundational to Meritz all along for generations. So what we found is that what was missing in the event space was a true commitment to design and intentional design. And what was happening was in most events, it was cut and paste, right? Is you rinse, wash, and repeat and do the same thing year after year after year after year at your meetings. Well, that didn't make any sense. So we developed a robust design practice. We started creating that at Meritz in 2011. Our head of brand, Greg Bogue, worked hand in hand with Jim Gilmore and has built that. We now have a master designer internal certification program that we do on an annual basis. We're just kicking off our next class at the end of September. And it's really foundational to how we work with every single one of our customers is we sort of want to get in a room with the right stakeholders and tear that investment of an event or a portfolio of events down to why are you doing it? What are the goals? What are the objectives? What are the impressions you want to deliver from the organizer and the guest? And then we have a very robust design practice that then designs that event or portfolio of events for our clients. And it has been a critical differentiator for us in the marketplace. And we've also seen most of our competitors copy and try to replicate that in one way or another, which is, you know, a confirmation that we're doing the right thing.
Absolutely. Anything else comes to your mind when you think of innovation, especially things that you did during the COVID period, which then spun off into major initiatives?
Yeah, I think the key thing now, and I'm sure we're going to get into it, is AI, right? Is, you know, we were doing a lot of things. We had a virtual trade show solution that we rolled out, and that worked. But that has obviously quieted down quite a bit. We continue to evolve our tools like EventBit, a new lead retrieval app as well, and you know, many other sort of products and services that we've evolved during that time. But right now, a lot of focus and attention, probably the last 2 years, has been zeroed in on AI and the impact that AI can have both on our business internally and then with our customers externally.
It's time for a short break. Stay with us. After the break.
We've had a robust investment in AI for the last 2+ years. It's been part of our strategic plan. We've got an AI steering committee. We've rolled out AI to every employee in the company. That's using Microsoft Copilot. And I can tell you it's driving a lot of efficiency. But I think there was a perception heading in that AI was going to replace the workforce, right? And that's just, at least in our experience and what we're also observing, is just simply not the case.
You are listening to a Bizcast Audio Original. Podcasting is one of the fastest growing content marketing avenues today. We can help you exploit this largely untapped marketing opportunity. We can craft your audio strategy and leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that smartphone penetration provides. It is powerful and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to target audiences. Welcome back. I'm Shubhanjan Sarkar, your host for the Trade Show podcast and founder of PitchLink, the visitor engagement platform. Let's dive right back into the episode. AI is like possibly right now the most abused word as well.
Absolutely.
So,
there's a great article that that came out. I don't have it with me right now, but it came out of one of the big consulting practices, and it basically talks about the big lie of AI. Now, that's one set of research and one point of view,
sure.
But there is a lot of misinformation and misinterpretation, I think, of AI. And one of your questions is, you know, what are the things are we avoiding as an industry? I don't think we're avoiding it, but I'm not sure we're being 100% realistic and honest about AI and the impact it can have on our business and our industry as a whole. So we've had a robust investment in AI for the last 2+ years. It's been part of our strategic plan. We've got an AI steering committee. We've rolled out AI to every employee in the company. That's using Microsoft Copilot. And I can tell you it's driving a lot of efficiency. But I think there was a perception heading in that AI was going to replace the workforce, right? And that's just, at least in our experience and what we're also observing, is just simply not the case. It's increasing productivity. It's increasing efficiency. It's driving process efficiency. And maybe we don't have to hire as many people, or maybe there's a role we don't have to backfill, but it's certainly not replacing our workforce. There are a couple areas that perhaps in the future might have a little more of an impact, but we're not seeing that. It's sort of the 80-20 rule, right? AI can get you 80% of the way, but that 20% is really the critical part.
Yeah.
And that requires human intervention. It requires the expertise and knowledge of our team in order to really deliver the value. So we went out, we did 12 different potential use cases for AI. We narrowed those down to 6, which are proof of concepts. And we're now executing against 6 different proofs of concepts at different timelines and different levels of investment. A lot of it is internal. You know, you can look at areas of our business that, you know, we have a proposal or solution design, a lot of efficiencies in how you capture content and then recraft that as part of your deliverable to a customer. You look at event billing, you know, very complex, right? Massive spreadsheets, multiple spreadsheets. AI can really drive efficiency there. We've got some other opportunities around our meeting and event management team and all the processes and functions that they focus in on. So, you know, each one of those is an opportunity for a significant improvement in the business. And that's where we're zeroing in and focusing our time. And then you look at what is the impact on, let's say, a trade show attendee, right? How do you use AI to improve the lead retrieval process? How do you use it to improve the attendee experience, right? Because we do a lot of research and and study on the next wave of the attendee, right? My generation's quickly out of here, and it's all about Gen Z and Gen X, right? That's 75% of the workforce by 2030. That yeah. also means that's 75% of the attendee base. So how do you use AI to drive what they're looking for, which is sort of mass personal customization, right? I want that event organizer and content to talk to me as an individual. Well, you know, AI can have a dramatic impact on that through the use of algorithms and other data analytical tools for us to deliver a better experience for that individual. And that's exactly what they're looking for.
So right now, these six initiatives that you have, are they internal or are these developing services which you then will offer to your customers?
Yeah, most of them are internal, but they then have a dramatic impact on our customer. So I'll use event accounting as one. It doesn't sound very sexy, but we do a lot of that, right, for massive, you know, citywide events, trade shows, et cetera. And the ability to turn around billing and accounting in a very efficient way helps us a lot, but it's also a massive improvement for our customers. So, you know, that's an example of where that is direct impact to them. And then I think what we started with our AI practice is intentionally focusing internal. And then now we're starting to shift more to external use cases and opportunities that will directly impact clients.
Right, right. Let's move to attendee engagement. I mean, that's one point you had mentioned. And I think that's one topic that we talk a lot about, but you see very little happening.
Yeah.
I do not see, I mean, I know people talk of there is some bit of matchmaking happening, some bit of talk happening, but on the floor, you don't see a lot of that actually impacting. Last year, I spoke to over 200 attendees across 7 events across in North America, across about 6 cities. And you'll be surprised. And it's a very small data set. So it's I would not say that this is a representative, 100% representative of what's happening. I asked them that what stood out. And these are a mix of different kinds of trade shows. And believe me, 100% of them said nothing. My second question was, what was the most exciting thing, conversation or most exciting thing that happened to you while you were here? And as you would imagine, it is, oh, I bumped into Tom. I had not seen him post-COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a good friend. We normally would have met in most events and trade shows, and I had not seen him for 3 years, and I bumped into him. So I asked, is there any conversation that stood out? And the answer is no. So that's sort of, and I also happened to have Nancy Drapeau of CIR. She came and spoke about the work that IAE has been doing in terms of attendee engagement and things like that. A lot of talk is about entertainment and having fun, organizing and having fun. Yet the latest Freeman report talks about, no, people actually want to do business. So, I mean, we're like, we get a lot of conflicting data. It depends on who you're talking to, what are the questions that they're answering. I don't Correct. Think these are all independently wrong or right answers. These are sort of representative of what's going on. So what do you think is going on, and what do you think should be happening, which is not happening yet?
You know, I'll almost equate it to the discussion we had around ROI, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, 40 years later, we're still having the same conversations. And it's kind of a indictment to some degree on the industry and how we kind of just keep recycling. And we are not really seeing incremental or significant transformational change. Again, I'll go back to our design practice. One of the things that we focus in on is just that, right? If you design an event, and that goes to a trade show event, educational event, the list goes on, and you do a proper job of that design, you will address I think a majority, maybe not all, but a majority of those issues. And I think, you know, we go back to a lot of work we're doing. We're just ready to come out with a document and a white paper on next gen, right? And that's focused on our partners and destinations, right, around the country and around the world. And, you know, it's something that has to be taken very seriously about millennials and Gen Z and Xers being the majority of the attendee base in the workforce very, very quickly, right?
Yeah.
And and they have a different set of expectations and needs. And if we're not taking that seriously and not designing of how we need to engage in the way they're all digital natives, right? They have all grown up in a very different way than we did. And so we have to treat them differently. We have to design around them differently, communicate and engage with them very differently. We work with a doctor, Dr. Corey C. Miller, who is a particular expert on Gen Z. And she's spoken at virtually every one of our events for the last, I don't know, probably 4+ years. And she's it's fascinating to hear her feedback on how do you design, how do you engage that audience because of their uniqueness. And I've never been a big generational believer because I don't behave like a typical boomer and you probably don't either. And so getting categorized like that, it doesn't really work around that. But I think behavior is really an area of focus. But this generational work around particularly Gen Z and millennials is real. And it is something that we have to take very seriously. So, you know, I think it's an age old problem, but we got to take it seriously. I think you can do it through intentional design and then how you execute your events. And it will get us further down the path of really being able to answer that question once and for all. But, you know, if you and I met again in 20 years, we probably would have a similar conversation, unfortunately.
I think I'll agree with you absolutely. And by the way, it would be lovely if you connect me with this lady and maybe I can have a conversation with her about what she's seeing. It'll be interesting.
She's fantastic and incredibly knowledgeable. And I have 2 Gen Z kids, so it's fascinating for me to sit in her sessions. She has a Gen Z daughter. And so there's a lot of really spot on research and expertise in that space. And it's something we're spending a lot of time and energy around.
Yeah. Yeah. And also one of the things that I realized, I mean, my son is 33, so he's sort of in between somewhere.
He's more kind of a millennial, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And he's sort of teaching. He's in Cambridge and he's teaching, AI related stuff in the masters and all that. And he's teaching the Gen Z and some of the next ones. And I think there's a lot of oversimplification that we have done and have made popular myths about them and what they know and what they do and how they do, you know. I think there's a serious amount of misinformation and knowledge gap that exists. And we are very happy to run with some assumptions. And they're actually dead wrong.
Yes.
And so my interest in actually trying to hear and know and learn, one of the things that you mentioned is that we need to understand, actually. It is not that we can go and design something without understanding who our customer is going to be, right?
Absolutely. It's fundamental. Ask the right questions, get the right answers, and then you can craft and deliver a trade show, an event that actually does make a difference and has impact. And engagement is the number one goal, right? You got to engage your audience no matter in what environment you're in.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Want to touch on sustainability. This is something big for you.
It is.
And it's part of Marriott's, you know, triple bottom line idea. Why do you think that this is still good to have, nice to discuss, but we really don't have to do much about it?
Yeah, we look at it differently. We look at it as a business imperative, not a nice to have. And that's been the case really for the last probably 4 years, where we really created our environmental strategy and our environmental strategy practice. That's led by Rachel Riggs, who is phenomenal. She's been very active in the industry. She works with the EIC on a lot of their work, and then PCMA and other organizations as well. So we're not only working on ourselves, but we're trying to also help the industry. And we have a consulting practice around that. We have our own carbon measurement event tool that we use for our own events. And then we work with our customers on their events. But we see it as a business imperative. We've got a significant customer base that set specific standards for us as a supplier, as a vendor to them, that we have to meet. So it's not, you know, a general thing. It's no, you've got to have a Ecovata score of X or a CDP score of X in order to be on an approved vendor list and to continue to do business. We had one client in the pharma space that canceled four events because they had internally exceeded their carbon footprint measurement. And so we've lost four events because of their internal requirements for their own events. So and I think a lot of this is driven by Europe and the EU, but also, you know, more and more in the US, even with the current administration sort of taking their foot off the pedal, I'll just put it that way, around sustainability. States like California certainly are not. And, you know, so for us to do business there, there's absolute requirements that we have to meet. And we see that, and we see more and more customers expecting us to be able to deliver against AI and AI measurements as well. So, you know, those things are sort of going hand in hand. And I think as an industry, we've got to take it very seriously. You know, you see what's going on with the airlines, and I'll just point to Europe again, right? Short haul flights are now under scrutiny. You know, travel as a sort of weaponizing travel because of its impact on the planet, maybe is taking a bit of a lull now, but I don't think it's going to go away. I think we have to be very aware of that. And as you know, airlines are critical to our business, right? If we don't have healthy airlines and the ability to fly, how are we going to get people to our in-person events? So I've always pointed to the airlines as critical partners that maybe have not always been seen as critical partners. And we have to continue to evolve and nurture those relationships and make sure that they're in tune with what's going on in the, you know, trade show and event space.
Do you see organizers having similar standards? Like you mentioned your pharma client and you mentioned some other clients who are sort of forcing some numbers and sort of actively pursuing certain goals. Yep. Do you see many of the organizers sort of getting aligned there?
We do. And I think a lot of it is, you know, initially focused on waste, not only paper waste, but food waste. I think where I see the most scrutiny is around food waste. It's just criminal if we're not doing everything we can to maximize the use of food and to, and I'll use the term recycle, not in the normal, but to be able to reuse, right? So you see more investments in deep freezers so they can instantaneously freeze food so that it meets health requirements in order to be donated to, let's say, you know, homeless shelters or food banks. I don't think that's going away, and I think it's the right thing to do. So we absolutely see organizers having to look at the venues and what venues are selecting and what are those venues doing to maximize their environmental strategy and certification scores, et cetera. And then I think a lot of focus around waste right now. But I think, you know, again, we may be in a period where some of the pressure has been taken off, but I don't think that's going to be long term. I think it's part of being a good citizen on the planet. And we work very diligently with our customers to make sure that we understand what their goals are and also that they sort of match up and partner with us on our own internal goals.
Great. Two final questions. You have been awarded many, many times. What do these awards mean to you?
You mean personally?
Yeah.
Oh, I think it means I'm old. you know, it's like a cockroach that you just can't kill, right? He just keeps scurrying out and still exists. And but more seriously, I think it's a reflection of the organization and the organizations that I've been a part of, right? A lot of times you get maybe a personal recognition, but it's really based on the collective efforts of a team. And that's what I always try to point back to. We just got the Freedom Award from PACT, which is around our efforts in the fight against human trafficking. So it was awarded to me, but it was really an award to our efforts collectively since, I don't know, 10 plus years ago in our efforts in the fight against human trafficking. And so to me, okay, it's great to get that, but really the focus should be on the team. We have a steering committee. It's been employee led all along. They're the ones that need to get the credit. So, I mean, it's always nice to be recognized and for your contributions, but to me, it always more reflects the collective efforts of our team, our leaders, our people, and just the incredible industry that we get to be a part of. So, you know, I always try to look at it that way. And, you know, some of it comes with a title or some of it comes with the organization. It's always it's a nice to have, but I always try to reflect on why that award is being delivered and really the teams that are behind it that really are deserving of the recognition.
And why human trafficking? How did that come into your focus?
It's a very interesting, and I'll try to make it brief. Back in 2011, I was invited by Sabre, which is a GDS platform for the travel industry, to join them in a celebration of Delta Airlines signing the code of conduct or code of ethics with what was then called ECPAT, which is now PACT USA. And it's like, why am I getting this? What is human trafficking? I quickly started to do some research, and the first thing that popped up, and I've never been able to replicate this, was a picture, unfortunately, of a young gal in a hotel room being trafficked. And this is from a police report with the St. Louis Arch in the background. Hmm. And so we started doing some research and found out that our industry is foundationally involved in human trafficking because of convention centers, hotels in particular. You know, St. Louis, unfortunately, is a hotbed because of all the interstates that cross, and we're in the middle of the country. So, you know, trucking and transportation and railways and all those things. And so I brought it to our people and development team and said, here's an issue that is really involved in our industry. Our industry is not aware of it. Delta and I think Hilton at that point were the only really industry players involved. Hmm. And we collectively said it matches our core values and who we are as an organization. As I mentioned, we have four stakeholders, and one of them is our communities. And so we thought, as a community citizen, if we can help build awareness of this problem, then we can make a difference. So we've been involved since 2011. We do everything we can to every event we have. We fundraise for a local organization that's involved in the fight. And we do a lot here locally in St. Louis. Involved, there's Monarch, which does jewelry made by victims and survivors that generates funding. And then we support another organization called the Covering House, which helps individuals survive and escape human trafficking. So it's been a sort of core value match from us from day one, something we're proud of, and we continue to use it as a platform to build awareness. And you know, we support another event or initiative called Traffic Cam, which is an app that you can take pictures of your hotel room. It goes into a database that law enforcement can use. So when they see a picture of someone being trafficked, they can almost immediately identify not only the hotel, but the room. And so that's another powerful tool that we try to help promote. So it's just foundational to who we are and what we stand for as a company and being a good global citizen.
Yeah, I don't think we talk enough of the connection between the industry and human trafficking.
No.
I don't think I ever thought about it, and it was.
I never thought about it until I got that email. I mean, I didn't even know it existed as an issue, but it really is modern day human slavery and sex trafficking and all these things. It ties into homelessness and crime, and I mean it's. It's a pretty extensive issue.
Right. So finally, David, if you look out 5 years, with AI, we cannot do too much of looking out, right? Where do you see the industry 5 years from now?
Yeah, I think I'm really bullish on the industry, as you can probably tell. I think in-person events, and I'll use that term instead of face-to-face, I think in-person events will continue to grow in their importance. I think organizations found in 2020 that when they cut those investments and we weren't gathering, that their businesses suffered. So I think there's probably no better investment than in-person events than an organization can make, whether it's a trade show, a brand event, a sales incentive, whatever that list, you know, on and on and on. So I think, you know, we'll be looking, having some of these same conversations around ROI and attendee engagement and the impact of AI, we'll probably be having those conversations in 5 years. But I think we'll continue to see a significant growth curve. I think we'll be addressing some head-on issues like the weaponization of travel, sustainability, and you know, environmental impact. I think those things are not going to go away. We've got to be serious about it. And in 5 years, you will have had that huge shift of the attendee base and the workforce. And that's a reality. So I think, you know, it'll be really interesting to see where we are in 5 years. I most likely will not be working at that point, at least not on a full-time basis. But I'm really excited about where the industry is heading and the future of this this industry. So again, very bullish, very positive, and excited about what the future holds.
PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high quality engagement between buyers and sellers. Through its presentation and discussion modules, sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement process. PitchLink requires no installation or download, contains and manages the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without interruption. Connect with us on LinkedIn or visit TradeshowEngage.com. That is TradeshowEngage.com.
David Peckinpah, thank you so much for joining me today. And I really, really appreciate your time and all that you shared.
Thank you, Sivajan. It's my pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of episodes featuring great conversations on engaging your booth visitors and maximizing your ROI from your trade show investments. Subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you do not miss a single episode. Thanks for listening. Thank you for being with us today on the Trade Show Podcast, the podcast of record for the trade show and events industry. Here we talk to movers and shakers of the $50 billion trade show industry and identify ideas, challenges, tactics, and strategies to leverage the first-party intent inherent in the trade show business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and implement some of the ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of the Trade Show Podcast. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platform like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcast from, and give us a rating while you are at it. This is a Bizcast original podcast and is produced for PitchLink, the next generation visitor engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Shubhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.